food bloggers. Hi, how are you today? Thank you so much for tuning in to the Eat Blog Talk podcast. This is the place for food bloggers to get information and inspiration to accelerate your blog's growth and ultimately help you to achieve your freedom, whether that's financial, personal, or professional. I'm Megan Porta. I have been a food blogger for 13 years, so I understand how isolating food blogging can be. I'm on a mission to motivate, inspire, and most importantly, let each and every food blogger, including you, know that you are heard and supported. If there is one piece of food blogging that I believe we don't pay a whole lot of attention to, but we should, it is recipe development. Sally Cameron joins me. She is a food blogger over at A Food Centric Life. She's also a professionally trained chef, and she has a lot of experience with just food in general. She has such a passion for recipe development and brings this topic to the table in a really unique way. She gives us a lot to think about, such as putting really detailed notes together when you're testing recipes, considering your equipment, considering flavors, considering colors, also considering substitutions and ways that people can change the recipe, or maybe ways that people might make it in a different altitude. Really developing a recipe that is helpful for your user, and also being willing to hear feedback and adapt your recipe accordingly. She gave me so much to think about that I've literally never even considered before. So I think you're going to pull some really valuable nuggets from this episode. It is episode number 507, sponsored by RankIQ. Hello, food bloggers. Are you looking to spice up your social media account with unique and exciting content? If you want that secret edge that makes you stand out in your niche, I might have the answer for you. Katarina can help you streamline your podcasting and social media content with audio editing, video editing, or social media strategies. She specializes in working with food bloggers, tailoring her content creation packages to their needs. Whether you want to create something new, like a gripping podcast, or if you want to refresh your social media strategies by creating scroll-stopping video content for platforms like Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, she has got you covered. If this sounds intriguing, get in touch with Katarina. Go to eblogtalk.com/resources to get more information about Katarina's services. Again, go to eblogtalk.com/resources and click on her link. Now let's get back to the episode. Sally Cameron is a professionally trained chef, recipe developer, online content creator, speaker, and certified health and nutrition coach. She created all of the recipes for Dr. Mark Hyman's New York Times bestseller, Eat Fat, Get Thin, the New York Times million copy bestseller, The Daniel Plan, 40 Days to a Healthier Life, companion cookbook, and Sony 5 Essentials video series. She has been blogging at A Food-Centric Life longer than she'd like to admit. Changing her diet by going gluten-free and focusing on whole fresh foods, lots of plants, nuts, seeds, healthy fats, and quality proteins helped her to lose weight, get healthy, detox from heavy metals, and recover from Lyme, mold, and gut issues. With all of that, it's no surprise that special diets are her forte because healthy is a lifestyle. Hello, Sally. Welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Hi, Megan. I am terrific and just looking forward to talking with you. This is great. Yes. I love the blog. It really helps me a lot.
So good. Thank you for the podcast. Thank you for listening. I know what you meant.
Yeah.
Always good to, I love interviewing people who have been listening. It's just so much extra fun. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about recipe development today. But to preface that, why don't you give us a little background on your blog?
Let's see. I am a blogging dinosaur. I've been blogging forever. And of course, when you've been blogging for a long time, your site and your work goes through a lot of different changes. But I started it probably under a food-centric life. It's been about 11 or 12 years now.
Wow.
And before that, it was just something I was learning about and starting to play with whatever is blogging. And, you know, a friend said, hey, you should put your recipes out there, like I'm sure we've all kind of been told at one point. And so I did, of course, not knowing what it would really turn into. But it's called A Food-Centric Life because that's absolutely my life. It is, I live, eat, sleep, breathe, dream, think food. My husband laughs at me. He said, you have such a food brain. And I'm like, I know, I can't help it. It's just me. So not the easiest URL. I've often wanted to find something more simple, but it works.
Oh, I like it. And I love that you have a food brain. That makes you the perfect food blogger. So perfect fit, right? Okay. So how did you get interested in recipe development as you call it, like dinosaur blogger, a blogger who's been around for a while, an OG blogger, whatever you want to say? This is something that we do develop over time, I think. So at what point did you realize that this was a really important piece of it?
Well, I am a professionally trained chef, so I am used to being in that environment of creativity and having to write your recipes down. I always, as a kid, I worked in the kitchen with my mom, who many of us have had this experience, and many moms and grandmoms never wrote their recipes down, so you knew you better write them down because they weren't going to be around forever. And then as I got further into my blog, I became a certified health coach and a recipe developer. And I had an opportunity to work on my first cookbook, not my cookbook, but working on a cookbook for someone else's for hire. And I worked on the Daniel Plan cookbook, which was a companion to the New York Times bestseller, The Daniel Plan, which was all about healthy eating, healthy lifestyle, incorporating food and faith and fitness and everything into your journey. So I worked on the cookbook. And when you work on a cookbook for someone else, or whether it's your blog or for yourself or for a client or a sponsor or whatever, I mean, you have to formally develop, formally test. You often work within specific parameters for dietary needs or for, you know, with specific ingredients. And it just kind of, you start writing things down, you start notebooks, you start taking notes, and it all kind of just begins.
So you saw the importance through all of your different avenues to write proper recipes, I guess.
Yes, and a really great book. I was going to mention it later, but I'll mention it now. If you've been learning to write good recipes, is a marvelous book called Will Write for Food by Diane Jacob.
Oh, yes. I have heard of that.
Have you ever read that?
I haven't, but I've heard so many people recommend that. It must be great.
It's a fabulous book. My older copy, I don't have her latest version, but it is tattered and dog-eared and written in and sticky-noted, and it's really...
Nice. That's the sign of a good book, right?
Yeah, right. Isn't it true? And that you keep it and you refer back to it. But yeah, recipe development is just super critical. And it's because recipes have to work, you know, especially when you're working on either your blog or a cookbook for someone else or a project for someone else. Recipes have to be repeatable. They have to work. And that's the sign of a good recipe, is when it's repeatable and when people can understand it and reproduce it in their own kitchens. Even if you have different skill sets, even with different stoves and different equipment, you have to do the most you can and think through it to be sure that those recipes are going to be repeatable and that they're relatable. If they do, especially for a blogger, you will gain traffic, you will gain trust, you know, the EEAT that we all have held over our heads, but those practices will gain you traffic and readers, and then hopefully right in the end, it's revenue. So it's all tied together.
Yeah, all of that stuff adds up to the revenue, really, right? I mean, the trust, if somebody comes to you and doesn't trust a recipe that you've put up, then they're probably not going to come back.
And even if a reader has trouble with a recipe, but they know they can either email you or they can put in a comment and they can say, you know, I had this issue, and they know that you'll respond and that they know that you'll walk them through it. I didn't have this ingredient, but I used this and it didn't work, or it did work. They'll know that you're a resource for them and that you really want them to succeed in their kitchen.
So it goes beyond just the recipe development. It really goes to, are you willing to hear feedback and make changes based on that feedback? I never thought of it like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, just recently I had a really good example, and I ended up having a big long email conversation with the reader, but there's one recipe, I'm probably going to take it down now. It's a very, very old one. And it was when I used to kind of incorporate a little bit of travel, because we love to travel. And it was travel, but it was a recipe from a restaurant that we ate in this particular city. And it was just a simple muffin recipe. But I put it up. It was from, they said, yes, it's in our cookbook. Yes, we use this in the restaurant. Here you go. And they allowed me to put it up. And I hadn't made it. It's the only recipe on my site that isn't really mine. And I've never actually turned right around and made when I got home. And a reader who really knows what he's doing, emailed me and said, I've tried this a couple times and I can't get this to work. And I tried the one from their cookbook and it didn't work. So we had this big long conversation and I could tell he knew what he was doing. And I haven't had time to test it and make sure it works. But as we all have to prune our blogging gardens, so to speak, it may be one I just take down at this point. But, you know, it didn't work. But at least he reached out and said, I can't get this to work. And we kind of brainstormed why.
Yeah, that's good. I occasionally have people reach out that say, like, this recipe didn't work. And it works for me. It's worked for me 100 times. It works for everyone else. Mm-hmm. What do you do in that case? That's so hard because I'm like, I don't want to dismiss your feedback, but maybe, I mean, the possibility is there that you're not a great cook or something, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah. Right. We all have comments like that, right? In fact, and all you can see that this is where your recipe development and your development journals and all of your notes come in handy. Because you can go back to your notes and you can confidently say to the person who's struggling, well, let me help you try and figure this out. But I did test this recipe many, many times and it's been repeatable by a lot of people, but I'd like to help you, you know, see if we can work this out and maybe, you know, ask them questions, right? Did you use my ingredient list? Did you change anything? Just try to understand where they are. I once had one of those really mad comments about, well, I could never make that recipe because I don't have that silver dish. And I had photographed a finished recipe in an old silver dish. It was the holidays from my grandmother. And it was just a vessel. It was just a dish. You could put it in any kind of dish you wanted.
That's hilarious.
But I read it. I still laugh. And I just tried very politely to figure out how to respond. And I said, well, you know, that's just a dish. And why don't you try the recipe as I created it? Because you can put it in any dish. The dish has nothing to do with how the recipe comes out.
Oh, you're so kind for saying that. Most people would be like, what are you talking about?
Well, yeah, it was pretty funny. But you know what? You also have to take a deep breath sometimes and go, there are some very interesting people in this world, and just let it go. I mean, you can respond kindly, politely, and try to help them through. But at the end of the day, you kind of just have to go, thanks for your comment. I hope you'll try it. Yeah.
Thanks for reading. I always try to ooze with kindness and err on that side.
Yes.
Because you never know what their experience is or what they're going through in their life or in their kitchen. You just don't know. So I'm always like, thank you for
your
comment, even if it's really rude. Just appreciate that you're here. I'm really sorry you had this experience. And I used to get really upset about those comments, but anymore I'm like, what's the point of getting upset with people over that? It's just not worth it.
It is true. You can't waste your energy on it. You can try and help them. And like you said, ooze with kindness. I love that. That will always be a good solution. And then move on. Because, you know, most of it is positive and most of it's good and thankful. So,
okay. So where do food bloggers start with recipe development if they feel like they just need to hone in on the skill a little bit more? Maybe they're just getting started.
Well, first of all, you need to define your purpose. Is your recipe development, is it for your blog? Is it as a service for other bloggers? Is it for hire, such as a sponsored post or for brand work? Is it for a cookbook, a magazine, for a newspaper column, right? There's many reasons you're going to potentially work on recipe development. Now, mostly it's, you know, for your blog or as a service for other bloggers or sponsored stuff. But first define your definition and your purpose. Who's the audience? How experienced is that audience? Think about who you're writing for and what their skill set is, what their potential capabilities are in the kitchen, their abilities are, and kind of go from that direction. And then you need to find inspiration, right? I think all of us that have food brains, because we're food bloggers, we find inspiration in a ton of ways. It might be a meal out or a travel to a new place. It might be like a new tool, like when Instant Pot came out, when air fryers hit the market, you know, a new tool. It might be an old family holiday favorite or a seasonal recipe. Maybe somebody is diagnosed with a need for a dietary change, like you have to go dairy-free or you have to eat gluten-free. That's always a big switch. Maybe you're walking by a newsstand and you see a picture on a magazine. You go, oh gosh, that I could do this with that. Here's how I'd make it. Or maybe it's a hot ingredient trend like cauliflower or cottage cheese. So there's just inspiration everywhere. And I keep a running list at all times on my phone of all of my ideas. I just throw them into a list.
I love that because there's so much opportunity with food to be inspired because we all love food, right? Uh-huh. Food is delicious.
Yeah, and we've all got to eat. So
yeah, we all have to eat. I love your idea to just note maybe like a billboard or somewhere where you see a picture of food and might be inspired mm-hmm. by that. So do you, when you are inspired randomly in public or wherever, do you have a notebook or how do you remember those things?
Well, first of all, I am a real writer. My mother thinks I was born with a pencil and a notepad in my hand. So I like to physically write. And that's why I have a notebook for each year. That's my journal. I'm doing my keyword stuff and I'll do my research stuff and my ideas and my planning and then all my recipe development in one journal for the year. And they're physical and I've scribbled all over them and splashed in them. And I like to work that way. But if you're more comfortable digitally, then, you know, go ahead and take pictures and keep files on your phone. I do when I'm out, like you said, I will just either do a little voice thing and send it to myself so I remember. If I can flip open my phone and go to my running list and make a list, I'll take a picture of something and then put it in a category on my iPhone Photos called the album is Food Ideas so that I can go back and look at a picture and capture whatever it was that inspired me. So there's lots of ways you can capture your inspiration. I think most of us usually have too much inspiration. It's like inspiration overload. Oh,
that's so true. Yeah, we have to rein it in a little bit and kind of align it too with keyword.
Know. What's reality?
Yeah, right. And keyword research too, right? Yeah. And how do you let keyword research influence your inspiration?
Well, when I know the kind of a recipe that I want to develop, and I look at what all the ingredients are, I go to my keywords and I see, is there an opportunity here if I put my time and energy and resources into creating this recipe, photographing it, posting it? That's a lot of work. Am I going to have an opportunity for that to be successful? And I know when I was just learning about keyword research and doing Aleka's class on cooking with keywords, which is such a great and important course for people to take, you just, you know, if people don't find your, if they can't find your recipe, then what are you doing it for? I mean, sure, you need to do it for yourself and for your family. Maybe keep it in your journal for one day when you can figure out how to keyword it, if it's going to be successful or times change. But you have to make sure that with keywords, you're going to be able to get that out there and people are going to find it. And sometimes, you know, so often it's just a way in how you word your title, right? So I always will, when I have an idea, I will sit down after I have the idea and go through my search tools to find out if I think there's a way I can keyword it, that it's going to be successful and going to be found after I put the work and the development in.
Yeah, that's great advice. Yeah, if people can't find it, what's the point of creating the recipe, right? It's just going to be a page on a website.
I know that's frustrating. I've got recipes on my website now that I want to overhaul that are good, solid recipes. But when I look at the level of competition for the keywords, I'm not sure that they'll ever rank. So then you have to just make up your mind whether you'll put the development in for yourself to enjoy, and that's okay, and for your family and friends. And maybe it won't rank, but you know, you just have to weigh all the odds.
And then how do you deal with flavors outside of maybe your niche or like the American diet? Do you find inspiration internationally?
Well, something I do, and I have a running list of, something I thought about posting sometime for people, because I've got page after page of notes. And that is looking at international flavor profiles for recipe development is a great way to go. It's like last summer, I had a Greek salad recipe on my site that I loved, but it wasn't being super competitive. And I thought, there's got to be a way that I can word this, maybe change up the recipe a little bit. And I found a way to do it, and it ended up being a Greek pasta salad. But then, okay, what's a Greek flavor profile? Well, what about the herbs and what about the veggies and the cheeses? I mean, you think about all the yummy things in Greek culinary cooking, right? So there's all the wonderful olives and olive oil and oregano and feta and seafood and all kinds of things and lamb. So then you can see if your recipe fits within those profiles, or if you say, oh, you know, if I want to take it down this path, maybe I could use this. And so having those international flavor profiles just noted that you can review sometimes will help your development in terms of giving it a certain flair, giving it a certain taste. It's just, it's fun. And especially, you know, Mediterranean cooking, let's take that one as an example. Because people say Mediterranean cooking and they think of, well, France and Greece and Italy and Spain. It's like, but there's so much more to the Mediterranean than just those major few major profiles and those few major, you know, culinary experiences. I mean, there's all of North Africa. There's all of the Eastern Mediterranean. So just becoming familiar with some of those will also help your creativity and your inspiration and maybe help you hone a recipe when you're developing a little better.
Oh, I love that. So getting really inspired by the flavors and not necessarily making your dishes like this is an all-out Mediterranean dish or anything like that, but you're just finding inspiration in different areas of the world.
Yeah. And if, you know, and you might find, oh, I really seem to like these kind of recipes. And there's a fun example here is I have two good friends who are from Hungary and they're so cute. I adore them both. And I knew they were both from the same country because they have exactly the same cute accents. And there's a couple of very famous dishes. And I said to them both, hey, I would like to make this recipe. Will you please show me how you make it? What's traditional? What's authentic? So that I've got, you know, kind of from the horse's mouth, right, what the real deal is. I think today we have to be sensitive to calling recipes authentic being sure that they are, or, you know, cultural appropriation. That was a whole big thing and kind of still is. We just have to be careful when we say authentic that maybe it is, or you can always use inspired by or adapted from or whatever. So that, you know, I think that if you're working within a country's or a culture's profile, it's to want to cook like that, to want to experience it, to want to share that with other people is very flattering. And you never know where that will take you. Maybe it will take you to want to see the country and experience it authentically, but it can just take you on a different journey.
Love that. So we've found inspiration somewhere and we've aligned it with maybe a keyword that we want to focus on. Mm-hmm. Now talk us through how we actually create that recipe.
Okay, so this is where for me research and brainstorming really comes in. And I'll sit down with my notebook and I'll just brainstorm a list of potential ingredients, herbs and flavors and spices and proteins. And I might note the different cooking methods. Is it braised? Is it roasted? Is it grilled? Is it just sauteed or steamed? So I just brainstorm what the potential for that recipe idea could be. And then I start kind of weeding it out. Yep, this sounds good. Or no, this is a little bit too exotic. Most people aren't going to find it. Or no, this is could be a little bit of a pricey ingredient. Now, you can always mention things like that in your post. But when you're creating and crafting the recipe, when you're developing it, you need to be careful of those kinds of things, too. So, you know, what are the commonly included ingredients in a particular recipe? How is it generally or traditionally made? You know, the tools, the process, the timing, the method. Then you can analyze competitive recipes and traditional recipes and cookbooks and magazines and online and note maybe common ratios or common servings. And then you need to think about how will your recipe be different from what's out there and why, what's going to make it different. And also, you know, does it fit within your site? Does it fit within your mission or your niche? So those are all things that you go through in brainstorming. And sometimes it's a very simple recipe and it doesn't take a lot of time. And sometimes it's a more complex recipe. So you just keep your notes and sometimes I'll work on one for a bit and it isn't working. And then I'll go on and I'll work on another one that I've begun. So it's okay to go back and forth as you are inspired and kind of go from that direction. But research and brainstorming before you invest the time, energy, and money to develop a recipe.
Yeah, I think the more notes I take, the better. So when I take a ton of notes, even if it's just overkill and I'm writing down, oh, this was slightly salty or whatever, like the more, the better, because then your content can become more robust and more helpful for people.
Totally agree. And I do the exact same thing, Megan. I take tons and tons and tons of notes. And sometimes it's just small things, but you never know when that little small thing is going to be important, either in a comment and you can say, oh, yeah, or it's good for a chef's tip within your post. Or when you do like a substitutions and variations section, you can mention some of those things. Or tips to making a recipe successful, you can mention them. So I don't think there is having too many notes. There's no such thing. Whether they all end up in your recipe or your post is a different story. But in your development journal.
Or down the road, if you do get a comment that is questioning something, you can go back to your notes and see if there's anything about that, right?
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, I tried that and you can do that, but I like the flavor of this better, which is why I noted it. So.
Hello there, food bloggers. Are you wanting to tap into additional revenue and improve your site experience for your users? If you're saying yes to all of this, then Chicory might be a really great fit for you. Chicory is a leading monetization platform for food bloggers, enabling you to integrate highly relevant, shoppable ads into your recipe content and earn revenue from top CPG brands. Chicory's hyper-contextual ads and shoppable technology will help you improve your site experience and engagement, allowing your readers to go from inspiration to checkout in just a few clicks. Enjoy easy installation and ongoing access to the Chicory team at zero cost to you. Chicory makes it easy to track your earnings, optimize your blog content using recipe insights, and connect with its team. Here is a testimonial from a happy Chicory user. Quote, cooking and baking is my passion. Chicory makes it simple and easy for me to share that passion with the Where is My Spoon audience, providing a seamless purchasing journey for my readers and an effective monetization model for my blog. End quote. That is from Adina Beck from Where is My Spoon. Head over to eblogtalk.com/resources, scroll down to the Chicory logo, and click that button that says Learn More About Chicory. Or you can go to chicory.co/foodbloggers to learn more and to sign up. Now back to the episode. Okay, so you got your recipes made, you have all of your notes, then what do you do next?
That's kind of when you put on your creative cap. And like you've already talked about, like we've thought about the role of flavors, and you know, flavors are so important, of course, but they're powerful memory makers and they transport you to another time and place. So then maybe you outline your recipe real quick. Okay, let's say it's a chicken recipe. Well, I'm going to use, you know, boneless, skinless chicken breasts, or it's going to be bone-in chicken breasts. And how many do I need, or how many pounds do you need? What kind of an oil, let's say it's a recipe you're going to saute on the stovetop. Okay, what oil am I going to use? What other oils could people use if they wanted to? Like I cook so much with olive oil, but I also think, you know, that avocado oil is good. Coconut oil can be good, and a good neutral oil, but not vegetable oil. I am not a vegetable oil person because most of it is just not very healthy the way it's made. And I will note that. That just goes back to my nutrition background and my health coaching certification and all that. But I'm very focused on healthy recipes. And I'm also gluten-free. So that, you know, applies. Although I'm not purely gluten-free, I should have said that in the beginning. I try to make sure that anybody who comes to my site will find recipes that they can enjoy and can work with, but then I make notes for special dietary needs, because that kind of became my background. You know, when you're a chef, people, first thing out of their mouth is, oh, what's your specialty? And I didn't really know how to answer it for so many years. And then it hit me and it was, oh, well, it's really special diets. It's really having to help people learn to eat in a new way if they have to. And you think about those things, right? Okay, I'm going to use flour in this, but is it going to be wheat flour or is it going to be gluten-free flour? Are there common allergens in it I might need to make a note about? And once you jot down what you think a loose recipe is, then you make it the first time. You see how it goes. You keep that notebook right by your stovetop and you make notes. Okay, I liked this. I did this for so many minutes. Oh, this is going to work. I'll maybe try this next time. And you just really flesh it out to see how it's going to work. And that's where, when I start my testing, especially as you get more into formal testing and you're trying to really finalize a recipe, I have a 4-step timer that is on my stove or on my counter. And I, because it's got 4 different sections in it, have you seen those? They're really neat.
No, but I am intrigued. Tell me about it.
I think it's made by ThermoWorks. I think I bought it on Amazon probably, but you know, it's a little tricky to use sometimes. It took me a little bit of time to figure out how to use the thing. But like yesterday, I was working on a recipe. The top recipe was my prep time. The top timer was my prep time. The second one was like the first stage of the recipe. It was, it's a soup. So it was like the saute portion with the veggies and the carrots and the celery and the onion. And then the next section was, okay, how long does it have to simmer? And then the fourth. And so you have all your times and you can hit stop on one, move on to the next and capture all of your times so that when you go to say, how long is this recipe going to take? You can add up your time, give it a little bit of leeway, and then you know.
That is amazing. I'm not kidding you. Like maybe 2 weeks ago, I was in my mind thinking there needs to be a timer out there that has multi timers in one, and it exists.
It's really neat. And it's big and heavy. I mean, it's not a small gadget. It's probably a good, 6 or 8 inches high and 4 or 5 inches across. It's a beast. But when you're doing stuff like this, I just look back at my time yesterday when I got it done. I went, okay, 8 minutes here and 12 minutes here and 15 minutes here and 6 minutes here. And I went, oh, okay. So I know the basics of how I was working and what people should, expect. And I try not to rush because I know that I can prep faster than people. So I try to just take a deep breath and go a little bit more slowly so that I'm not over or underestimating the time it's going to take to work on a recipe to get through it.
So you take all these notes and then you transfer them. Do you directly make an outline? Do you write a post? How do you translate that to the blog?
Yeah, I'll go through all my scribblings and my splashes on, look at all my notes, and then I try and write out a clean final recipe. And then I will make sure that I'll go through my notes and make sure that I've included everything and try and maybe condense it a little bit into, because, you don't want to be too windy and too long-worded with recipes. It has to be concise. So I will go through and write up a recipe and I'll put it in my recipe card because we all live within the parameters of our recipe cards. So it's kind of about documentation time. And first you do like what's in the recipe, and then you outline your recipe with what your ideas are. And then you do your recipe testing with your tools and your timers. And also thinking about the obvious things like, you should also, I think most of us these days have digital thermometers. You should always, use those. And a digital kitchen scale is something really critical for weights and measures, and I weigh and measure everything for accuracy and then for descriptions when writing the recipe. And those are a very inexpensive tool. You can buy them on Amazon for $30, $25, $50, whatever. They have something called a tear feature. Are you familiar with digital kitchen scales?
Yes, but I don't know the tear feature.
Tear, T-A-R-E, will allow you, first you put on a bowl and it will weigh the bowl. You hit tear, it goes to zero. Then you can pour in your next ingredient, weigh it out, and hit tear, it takes you to zero. It's especially good with baking because you can measure faster and weigh. But then, and I do everything with weights and measures, and I note both because, what's a medium onion, right? I mean, is it a cup? Is it a cup chopped? Is it 8 ounces? Is it 10 ounces? So I make those notes, very detailed notes, when I'm developing, and I weigh and measure in different ways for accuracy, and because it's really got to be accurate. So noting how much each recipe takes, and then I write it out and I try and put it within, my recipe card, and I look at what I'll do is I'll put it in to my recipe card and I'll run the nutritionals on it and I'll see if they make sense. Oh, is this too high in fat? Is it balanced in protein? Is it trying to, am I accomplishing what the need of my recipe was? I mean, it depends more if you're have a special dietary focus, like you're low carb or you're keto or you're paleo or whatever. But look at the nutritionals and make sure that it makes sense.
Oh, I like that suggestion.
And then I write it out.
That's a great one.
But what I do too is I work. When I cook my own recipes off my site, I use my own recipes. And sometimes my friends have said, are you cooking from your own recipes? And I'm like, yes, I do this so that I can double check myself. Does it still work? Is my timing right? Did I describe it accurately? Can I make a word that's a little bit more helpful for somebody? And sometimes then you can go back and you can make a little extra note.
That is such a great point. Okay, I just did this last weekend. I was making a soup that I hadn't made in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I could have done it by memory, but I didn't. I went onto my site and I did exactly what I was saying, except I did make a few adjustments. I added an extra can of diced tomatoes. I added a little bit more pasta. Yeah. And so I might go back in there and revise it. So I think that's a really good recommendation to use your own recipe and then alter if needed.
It's good. And what I'll do is I'll go to my site and I'll print the recipe to see how it prints too. And then I know I can scribble over my printed recipe, take it back to my desk, and then make any updates like you, a little extra pasta, or you can add an extra can of tomatoes. In fact, yesterday's test for me, I was revamping an old chicken soup recipe that I did for a cookbook years ago. And I thought, oh, you know what would be good in this? I could include this. I wanted to add some leeks to it. Oh, I love leeks. So I added leeks to the soup to give it a little bit different twist. And I made it with a different herb. And then I went in and I'm going to make a note about, you can try this herb too. So it's just a kind of evolution. Oh my gosh, yeah. And it also shows that you care about your recipes. You care about your readers when you're continually looking to double check yourself, to double check your recipes that you have developed and see that they still work.
Great point. How much recipe testing do you do? So before you put a recipe up for the first time publishing it, do you do a certain number of run-throughs, or does it depend?
It depends. It depends. First, it depends on the kind of recipe. You know, some recipes are very simple. I mean, if you're doing a grilled chicken recipe and it's a marinade and some chicken, it's no big deal, right? So it's pretty simple. But I think the recipes that take longer are recipes that have sauces that might be a little bit more complicated. Oh, the one from last year I did was I overhauled my waffles recipe. Oh my gosh, that took, I don't know, 5 or 6 tests. Easy. And my neighborhood loved it because my neighbors volunteered to eat all my tests.
I love it.
And I did them all on a Sunday. And people were literally, is your next batch ready? I'm going to run over and pick them up. Or my husband was running them down the street. And just like, it was like waffle day on my street, in my neighborhood. And, you know, I got it to where I wanted it to be until I knew it was perfect.
Yeah.
So the recipes like that do take more work. And especially if you're, for example, if you're like, I'm gluten-free. So if I was originally a wheat-based flour recipe, is it going to work the same way? So if you're translating a recipe due to special dietary needs, then there is often more testing involved. But a lot of things are just naturally, you know, good the way they are, and you don't have to do too many tests. But sometimes I can do it with 3 or 4 tests, and sometimes it's 6 or 7 tests. And sometimes, like with one recipe I have messed with it and messed with it for off and on for so many years. And it's because I'm trying to find a way to make it easier for people. Yeah. And I've made it, I don't know, 3 or 4 different ways. It never seems to come out the same. And my husband's like, can you duplicate that? I'm like, I don't know. I have to go take notes. So he's, well, better write that one down. That's his favorite line. Better write that one down. Okay. I'll write it down. Whatever I did. But it just depends. Testing's critical. But sometimes it's just like snap and it just works,
yes.
Right?
Oh,
and you make it again and it works. And you're like, oh, I love this. This is great. This one's just unnatural. And you know that it's going to be easy for people. And sometimes it's one that you have to make a bunch of times to get it right. But when you get that one tougher one done, you're like, you're proud of yourself. You're like, yes, this is going to work for people. It's going to be really good. And it works.
My dinner rolls, it took me forever and ever and ever. But man, it is the most perfect recipe. And I totally get what you're saying about just noting all of those details. Like, you need a thermometer. You need the dough to feel exactly like this. You need to let it rest in a warm place. Mm-hmm. You need those details. Otherwise, others are going to fail just like I did many times before I got it right.
I know. They'll think, why didn't this come out? And nothing. That's one thing you don't want is when somebody makes your recipe and it doesn't work for them. You know, they're either going to be mad or they're going to be disappointed or they're going to feel like they wasted their time and their money or all of the above. And they're not going to be happy with you. And you don't want to do that to your readers. You want them to be excited. You want them to eat well and to serve their family well. You want all the, you know, the positives for them on why you created that recipe. So, you know, like you said, it's just. And the more cues you can write them into your notes when you're developing in your journal, it looks this color, it feels like this, it's about this temperature. I mean, all of those notes are the visual clues that will help them be able to replicate your recipe successfully. And those little notes are very helpful, but it also shows that you did your job. It shows that you care about your recipe development, that you really tested it, and you care about your reader, and you want them to be successful.
How often do you mention equipment?
I do. I don't do an equipment section anymore. If it's something in particular, I'll put it like in the equipment section of the recipe card. But I will always do like, you know, a high-speed blender, obviously, if you're doing things that require a blender, a Dutch oven. And sometimes I'll explain why. If there's a particular piece of equipment that It's like, you know, a blender versus a food processor versus an emulsion blender. Now, recipes sometimes can be made with all three tools, but what will the differences be, or are there no differences? Because not everybody has a food processor. To me, it's like, well, doesn't everybody have a food processor? I can't imagine living without one. I've had one for an eternity. But not everyone does. I have a girlfriend. She really hasn't liked to cook, but she had some dietary challenges. And she said, I'm going to learn to cook this year and you're going to help me. I'm like, okay. So she had no tools. I mean, she didn't even have a blender.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, okay, you need to invest in some basic tools. And she did. And she started following some of my recipes. And I told her which ones to try first that were simple. And she got excited. And she really started cooking, and her family was happier, and she got through her, you know, improving her health situation. And, you know, but you just have to, I always think of her, will Lene have this? Will she have a blender? Will she have a pot like this? Does she have this size? And sometimes I'll call and ask her, and we'll work through it. And I think, well, how can I make this work for her?
Yeah.
And you have to really keep in mind, everybody has different kitchens. Everybody has different stoves, different ovens, or they're in a different place. Now, you know, I'm not a kid anymore, and I've collected a lot of cooking equipment through the years. So I've got a really big arsenal to pull from when I'm cooking, but not everybody has had the ability to collect all of that. I mean, when we say Dutch oven, you know, there are some inexpensive ones on the market now, but, you know, I've had Le Creuset for 25 years. So I always think about that, and it's the weight of the pan, and it does affect how long something cooks, or the flame or the heat that you have under it. I mean, it all works together for recipes, but you have to keep your readers in mind. Do they have the stuff?
I never would have thought that someone wouldn't have a blender. That's so interesting to think.
I know.
Just really basic. Like, if you don't have a blender, what do you do for things that need to be? Yeah. So interesting.
I know. Well, she was sort of financially limited for a while. So I helped her find like a really lower cost Vitamix, and she was so excited, and she saved for it, and she got it. And then she started making investments in better pots and pans, and she bought herself a decent knife. So it's, you know, just watching her, you know, make this progression. And I think those of us who know how to cook and have been cooking for a long time and it's our passion, we take for granted what we have.
Oh, so
and you have to put on another hat that says, okay, does everybody have this? Does everybody have that? And if not, how do they make
this
it?
Sometimes
the answer is, if you don't have this, you just can't.
Sure.
I understand that. But a lot of times there's a workaround.
Yeah, such a great thing to keep in mind. And also a reminder not to take our kitchen tools for granted. I just don't think of that. But I was thinking of like when you maybe process or puree, you know, crackers or something for a crust and offering, you can put that in a Ziploc bag and hit it with a spoon or something like that. Just providing those alternatives.
Yes. Run over it with a rolling pin.
Yeah.
Like my mother taught me when I was a kid. Yeah. I mean, there's a way. There is usually a way. Not always,
right,
but usually. And try and think about that for your ears. And if one of your friends makes it, like I tell her, you know, if you make this, you call me or you email me, you tell me how did it work for you. And what makes me the happiest is when she emails and said, oh my gosh, I made that and it came out great and we loved it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, if she can make it, hallelujah.
We're set. We're good.
Like, I know it's a good recipe. Yay. So I love her to death. And I'm just so excited to see her coming along in her cooking journey and that I'm able to help her and that she is diving in and trying some
recipes.
That's
amazing. I want to give her a big hug.
Yeah,
so what else do we need to know, Sally, about just recipe testing, creating the recipe, documenting it, any of that?
Well, let's see. You know, if like one of all the things that you need to take time, especially with baking, you mentioned like your dinner rolls. If there's a cooling time, note how long it's going to take to cool and then test it. If you have extra, you know, put it in the fridge and label it and see how it's like in 3 or 4 or 5 days. Do you still like it? Did it work well? Did it hold well? Freeze a little bit if you have some extra, and then date it and remind yourself in a month to take it out and thaw it and try it. Did it really freeze well, or are you just kind of guessing that it would? And don't guess about how long food will last. There's really good resources out there for food safety. I think I sent you the links. You could always put those in the notes. And don't necessarily take another site's notes on accuracy for, oh, it'll last 2 days, or it'll last 5 days, or if it's a sauce, it'll last a month, because I've seen a lot of mistakes out there that would not be food safe, in my opinion. I'm also, chefs, one of the first things you go through is your food safety certification. And it's something I've kept up for 20 years. And, you know, food has to be safe. So there are resources like foodsafety.gov, eatbydate.com. There's USDA stuff. There's stuff on like Mayo Clinic I've seen. So keep a list of your resources, keep a running list. And when you say, we'll last 5 days in the fridge, we'll last 3 days in the freezer, whatever, be sure you're right, because you don't want to get somebody having a bad experience. So it's, you know, being food safe, especially as we, you know, next summer when things are hot and people are out grilling and you're out at picnics or the beach or whatever, you have to be careful with stuff like that. Let's see here. Recipe writing. So this is a whole different book, and this could be a whole different conversation. I'm sure you've probably done them on the podcast. But you know, the basics are a short but clear head note, consistency around how you describe your recipes and what's most helpful for making the recipe successfully. Always notes at the end of a recipe card that will help your readers. And the hold back, you know, one of the big questions with recipe writing is, okay, is it a half an onion? Is it a cup of chopped onion? I will do both for accuracy. Depends on how you like to write your recipes. And that's where something like Will Write for Food really comes in handy, is that you should develop consistency on how you want to describe. Are you happier saying a half an onion and then over on that far right side of the recipe card saying 1 cup chopped? Or is it the other way around? Is it, you know, 3 medium carrots? Well, I've seen big carrots and small carrots. So you can say 3 medium carrots, but then I'll put, you know, a cup of chopped carrots. And that all is part of your recipe, your testing, your development, so that you measure something, you weigh something, and you chop it up, and then you measure it again, and you take all your notes. So that's important. And, you know, I realize that different people have different recipe writing styles. Or if you're developing for a client, they may give you a style sheet or preferred terms on how they want recipes written. Oh gosh, one of the books I worked on, I went round and around with their editors on how to describe food. They said, no, it has to be 1 medium onion. And I sent them like a picture and said, okay, these all say medium onions. This weighs 8 ounces. This weighs 10 ounces. This weighs 12 ounces. I said, if you say 1 onion, people aren't going to get the same results. So, you know, you have to just think about that. Also, if you want help on recipe writing, is on Diane J's website. Diane Jacob is who wrote Will Write for Food. She's become a friend of mine, and I've worked with her through the years too. She's great. But her website is Diane with 2 N's, J.com. And if you go to her archive area categories, there's all kinds of stuff out there you can read on recipe writing, and it will help you to become a better recipe writer. You've done all this work. You've tested, you developed, you put your time and money and energy, and you're ready to go. But now you got to make sure that you're writing it the right way. So there's a lot of good resources out there, books and websites and things that will help you to write better recipes.
Wow. This was just chock full of great information. So many tidbits in here that are really helpful and valuable. So thank you. This is so great, Sally.
Thank you so much for having me, Megan. I mean, I could talk about this all day long, and I'm sure I'm probably going to hang up and go, oh, you know, I should have mentioned that.
That happens all the time, by the way. People email me after and they're like, oh no, I forgot to say so many things. So you're not alone with that.
I know, but you know, the other thing too is, I mean, if somebody has a question on any of this or they have a specific question, I'm more than happy to answer them. If they just want to, you know, do the contact thing or put my link, you know, how they can reach me in the notes. If anybody has a question, I'm more than happy to answer them or guide them or give them my opinion or whatever. So, you know, it's just about helping each other, and that's why we're here.
Yes. Well, thank you for showing up today and helping all of us. We appreciate you so much.
Oh, it's such an honor. Thank you.
Yay. Well, do you have either a favorite quote or words of inspiration to leave us with today?
I have a favorite quote, and this, I think, really goes along with what we do as food bloggers and what you do as a podcast host who has hundreds and hundreds of podcasts under her belt. And it's from Billy Graham, and it says, "We are not cisterns made for hoarding, but we're channels made for sharing."
That's powerful.
And I think that's what this is about. We're not cisterns made for hoarding our information, hoarding our talents, our gifts, our experiences, but we're channels made for sharing those with others. We share our recipes. We share our experiences, our memories. We share, you know, our culture. We share so much passion for food. and for so much more through our blogs. And we do it in community to help each other, right? We do it in community here to support and help each other. So I think that's just a real good one I look at often.
Oh, I love that so much. And the people who are, most food bloggers are really forthcoming with information, which I love so much about our community. And the ones who are get the most back too. You get what you give, I think. I always say that to my boys. You get what you give, because they're always like, this is my candy. They're teenagers and they still do this. No, I'm not going to share Starburst with you. I'm like, what? Are you kidding? You get what you give. Like, share and you're going to get the same and more back, right?
You do. And it may not come in exactly the way that you expected to or at the time you expect, but it will come back. It's like planting seeds, right? Seeds grow, but seeds take time to grow. You don't put seeds in the ground and they just pop up and you have instant lettuce like I have in my raised bed garden. I love to garden and grow a lot of my own stuff, but it takes time. So when you plant those seeds, maybe the harvest is going to be later and that's just fine.
Great message. Thank you for sharing that, Sally. We'll put together a show notes page for you. And if you want to go look at that, you can go to eblogtalk.com/afoodcentriclife. Tell everyone where they can find you, Sally.
Yep, it's at afoodcentriclife.com, and you can just send me an email right there through the contact page. It's fine, and I think you're going to put that in the show notes on how to reach me too. And I'm happy to, you know, I'm on Instagram and Facebook and all that stuff like we all are these days, the love-hate relationship with social media.
I hear ya.
Oh my gosh, it's so hard to get it all done, isn't it? It is just so hard.
Oh, it is. It really is. That's a whole other conversation, right?
I know. That's why I want to go back to the podcast you did a week or so ago on planning. I'm going to make myself sit down and listen to it. I first listened to it when I was out walking. I thought, no, I need to listen to this one at my desk and take notes. So,
yes. Well, let me know how it goes when you sit down. That would be fun to hear.
I will. It's going to be great.
Well, thank you again, Sally, for being here.
Thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure. And thank you for listening, food bloggers. I will see you in the next episode. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Eat Blog Talk. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd be so grateful if you posted it to your social media feed and stories. I will see you next time.